Welcome to Conversations Different, a weekly podcast from the Santa Fe New Mexican, focusing on the interesting issues and people of northern New Mexico. This is your host, Inez Russell Gomez, and with us is Sheila Lewis. She's here to discuss how to reduce gun violence in New Mexico. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with the different approaches that you take in your various roles in the community. You're a volunteer on this issue and do a lot of work in helping people understand, you know, why too many guns can be a problem and why too many guns in the wrong hand can be a problem.
That's right. I have two separate roles in this world of guns. One of them is I'm the trainer for New Mexicans to prevent gun violence, and people know them as the folks who do the guns to garden tools and buybacks, and we're doing great work in that area. But a second group I work with is called the Alliance for Gun Violence Solutions, and that's just a group of citizens who wanted to get together and figure out how can we find some solutions for gun violence. We're not an anti-gun group, but we're an anti-violence group. We want to find an answer.
So this is the maybe a group that focuses on responsible gun ownership and how we can foster that in our communities.
Very much so. We're looking particularly at legislation, but we also really want to start conversations in the community between gun owners and non-gun owners. They are not that different. They're the same folks.
No,
we just need to talk to each other.
That's a great point, because who wants to live in a world where you're afraid a bullet's going to whiz by?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. One of the things I think about growing up is that my stepfather always kept his shotgun in the closet. And I used to ask him, I remember, that's not loaded, right? He goes, no, I use it for self-defense. And they lived way out in the country where the sheriff was an hour away, if that. So it kind of made more sense.
Yes. And I've heard that story from a lot of people living out in the country. They just keep it propped by the front door. And I say, well, aren't you worried about your kids? And I say, oh, no, my kids are trained to not touch it. They know that. And I say, do they have any friends who come over? Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And we actually never touched his stuff. So I can think, I totally get that. And I know that when I had a child and he was going to the ranch and he started crawling, I told my parents, either everything is put up and locked away or you'll never see him in your house. You can come drive and see me. And we had a very fierce discussion about it. And then that was fine, because they had a gun safe that was hidden. It's really cool. It was hidden in the fireplace.
You know, they've done some studies with young kids where they leave them in a room with a gun and they say, don't touch the gun. I'm going to be right back. And if you don't touch the gun, I'm going to give you a prize. Just about every kid touched the gun.
No, it's
it's just a fascinating object.
No, and if you don't have a gun to touch, you do your fingers and you make a gun.
Yeah, my favorite was the kid who chewed his peanut butter and jelly sandwich into the shape of a gun because his parents wouldn't let him have one.
Oh, I love that. It's not funny. That's what little boys do. And maybe little girls as well. I know my favorite Christmas present that I ever got was, I was 7 and I got 6 shooters with a belt, and it was just, I was the cowgirl of the neighborhood. Now let's talk about some of the tools that people can use legislatively. I know we passed an extreme risk protection order law, which people call red flag, and then it was updated. Talk about what that is.
Yeah, that's a really important law, and it's been passed and it's been used, and it was used very slowly in the beginning. We went for a long time with none of them, and now law enforcement is seeing the value of it, but it's a really difficult law for them to use. It was not written in a way that made it easy on them. For example, the law requires somebody to relinquish a firearm if they get a court order saying that during this time of their mental health crisis, they shouldn't have a firearm. Relinquishment means you bring it to the police station.
Right. And if I want my gun, I'm not going to take it to the police station,
right.
Am I?
Especially if you're in the middle of a mental health crisis. You're probably not feeling comfortable dealing with law enforcement. So it makes it really difficult for law enforcement to actually get the gun out of the person's hand. So other states have enacted a much simpler law, which just says a law enforcement agent can get a search warrant and seize the firearm. Just walk up and say, can I have your firearm? And most people will relinquish it that way. But if they don't, they'll say, I am going to come into your house and look for it. That's in other states, and we're hoping to get that in New Mexico.
So that would be another update.
Yes, that would be the best and most important update, because that's what's going to keep law enforcement safe. And when they feel safe, they're going to use this law.
Now, do people who can go report? Let's say I have a cousin who's having a mental breakdown, and I know it, and I also know that they, you know, like shooting sports. Okay. What do I do?
The way the law is written now, there's a very specific list of people, and it's all the people who you would think are family members. Long list of, you know, in New Mexico, we have big families.
Yes.
All those folks, former and present girlfriends and boyfriends, whether they cohabitate or not, that's one group. Another is employers and school officials. Those terms are a little vague because we're not sure if it's the child's. We don't know whose employer and whose school official it is, but that's not really the issue. What's unusual about this law is before that whole list is laid out in the statute, there's the word includes. The people who can use this law include, and then it lists all these people. In New Mexico, the word includes has a very specific legal meaning, and it means includes but is not limited to.
So other, let's say my neighbor is acting irrationally and walking around with a pistol on his hip and shooting birds out of the tree or something and then pointing it at me, that's something where I might be an include.
That's right, because that really means everybody has the opportunity to be a reporting party. And the way this law is written, the reporting party, that's the family member or the neighbor or whoever, tells law enforcement, and law enforcement is the petitioner. They go into court and they tell the judge the story of why this should take place. In the domestic violence world, the person who's fearful, often the wife, is the petitioner. So it makes it really complicated because law enforcement's used to the family member going into court in the Family Violence Protection Act. And in this act, law enforcement goes into court to do it based on the information they've been given. The important thing here is many family members, for very good reasons, get scared and bail on it. They don't want to follow through. And now the law enforcement agent has all the information in his head. For a long time, the courts were saying, if you don't have that reporting party, one of those people...
Doesn't count.
Now they're coming around and saying, well, includes, but is not limited to, includes law enforcement. So if they have the information, they can be both the reporting party and the petitioner. And that's made all the difference in the world.
And that's huge, because even if the law enforcement person isn't related, they know a lot of the mentally ill people with guns because they're on the streets. That's their job. They know where the problems are.
Often they have their own firsthand information. They've seen the person acting erratically. And the person has been acting erratically in a not very dangerous way for many, many months or maybe many years. And then all of a sudden you see this person is talking about a gun and talking in a much more elevated way about violence. That officer knows something's different. I need to act because I see where this is going.
Now, as we've seen in New Mexico, there are law enforcement officials who understand the importance of such a law. Then there's a whole bunch of them that want to protect everyone's Second Amendment rights up until the moment they shoot somebody. So they're not as interested, it seems, in prevention if they feel it violates this constitutional right.
Right. You know, I went to law school, and one thing that I learned in law school, it's not my opinion about what's constitutional. There's a court that tells us what's constitutional. And so far, there has not been a single court that has said these laws are unconstitutional because there's due process and because they're temporary. When the process starts, you lose your gun rights for 10 days. Then you get to go into court and have a hearing, and then the whole thing gets decided by a judge. And it only lasts for 1 year. So it's not taking away somebody's gun rights. It's sort of holding them in abeyance while they deal with their mental health issue.
And the potential is the kid who was going to get an automatic rifle and go shoot up his school, or the boyfriend that wanted to kill his girlfriend, because as we know in domestic violence, that separation is when it's the most dangerous. Those acts can be prevented.
Absolutely. And I really try to impress upon law enforcement, when somebody has a domestic violence order of protection, that's when you have to tell them about an extreme risk protection order, because the danger just got really enhanced. Now this person is really agitated and the danger is five times greater that's going to result in a murder. So you want to act at that point. And there are many law enforcement agencies that aren't opposed to the law. They just think, well, if she already got it, domestic violence order, we're done.
Yeah.
But they don't get, take the next step, take that really important next step and get that person before a judge who says you need to relinquish your firearm now.
And on that note, we'll take a quick break and be back for Conversations Different.
Thanks, Inez. This is Patrick Dorsey, publisher of the Santa Fe New Mexican. We hope you're enjoying this episode of Conversations Different with Inez Russell Gomez. Great local content is only possible with a talented staff dedicated to bringing you the best local content possible. For that staff to do its work, we need your support by subscribing to the Santa Fe New Mexican. If you're already a subscriber, thank you. And if not, there's never been a better time to subscribe. In addition to our home-delivered newspaper that comes with full digital access, we also provide digital-only subscriptions for SantaFeNewMexican.com. We'll also be releasing more online-only audio and video programming moving forward. The Santa Fe New Mexican has been here for nearly 175 years, and we want to continue being your source for local news and information. Visit us at SantaFeNewMexican.com/subscribe or call us at 505-986-3010. Thank you.
It's a new day in New Mexico, and the doors to boundless opportunity are open as tens of thousands of New Mexicans reach higher to pursue a dream, broaden their horizons, and retrain for a better job. With the New Mexico Lottery and Opportunity Scholarships, you could build yourself a better future anywhere in the state. You put in the hard work, we'll help with the costs. For eligibility details, visit reachhighernm.com.
Back with Sheila Lewis talking about ways to reduce gun violence. During the break, I was asking you if a domestic violence situation is dangerous enough that a person needs to get a restraining order or some sort of protection for themselves. Should the guns be removed from those people in, you know, or attempt be made to remove the guns in those cases?
Well, let's start with the simplest answer, which is many domestic violence situations do not involve guns and are deadly. Strangulation is very deadly.
That's one of the top keys that you're going to die if they start touching your neck.
That's right. So we know that it's dangerous, but there might not be a gun. So there's no reason to ask the court to order them. In the domestic violence situation, the judge is deciding a lot of different things. Who has the kids on which day? Who pays whom? Who has the car? Who has the house? A whole list of things. And at the very end of that list, the judge has to decide what to do about guns. And the first thing the judge has to do is tell the perpetrator, you may not have a gun. The law says while you're under an order of protection for domestic violence, you may not have a gun. Well, that's great, but those folks are not really in a mood to listen to judge orders that don't have any teeth. The next step is when the judge says, and I'm going to order you to relinquish it. They can do it in the domestic violence case, but they never do. They never want to take that next step. When you go in for an ERPO, you're telling the judge, look, something happened. I got this DV order of protection, and now he's doing things differently. Now when we argue, he's cleaning his gun in front of me. Now when we argue, he's making threats that I understand but might not have been so clear to anybody else because we have a language in our marriage.
Yeah.
So we want to acknowledge that she knows what he's saying. Then she goes into court and say, I have additional information I need to give you now, and let the judge hear that information and make the decision to order relinquishment.
Okay. Do you think enough law enforcement personnel and enough people just in general know about ERPOs, or the other term is red flag law?
Well, one of my jobs that I love the most is training people about ERPO. And so far, I've trained about 500 people in many separate situations, and including I train at the Law Enforcement Academy. So that's just started. So that's great. Just did 50 or so new recruits. So we have those guys trained. I've done a lot of police departments all over the state, community groups. So people are learning, but little old me, that's not enough. We need a big public education campaign to really help people understand. That's the first part. They have to know the law exists and they have to learn how it works. The next step is to make it work better.
I wonder sometimes if there is an affinity where, you know, police officers have such demanding jobs and a high divorce rate, and when they have to get involved in all those domestic violence cases, how do you get them maybe to look to the fact that guns aren't necessarily for protection, but they can be used for violence?
Police officers have to use their guns, and they're trained to use their guns. I respect their knowledge very much. When they're in their personal life, when they've taken off their uniform and they're sitting around and having a few beers and having a fight with their loved one, they're no longer police officers. This statute actually addresses that situation. It says when the perpetrator is a law enforcement officer, the petitioner is the attorney general or the district attorney. It recognizes in our statute this can happen and this does happen. I don't want to say that it happens a lot, but it does happen, and we want to keep all families safe, even the families of law enforcement agents who are having a difficult time in their life.
Yeah, it's an awful, it's a very, very stressful job. And going beyond ERPOs, what other things should we be doing that we're not doing?
Well, you know, we have a child access prevention law, a CAP law, and that requires people to keep their firearms locked up. It's brand new. It hasn't been used a lot. It's also the good news, because maybe there aren't a lot of kids taking guns from families, but maybe there might not be reported as much as it should be. The law is based on what the child does with the firearm. If the child doesn't create a whole lot of chaos, it's a misdemeanor for the adult. But if the child shoots that firearm and injures somebody, it's a felony. To me, that's a little bit late in the game, because we've already had a terrible incident happen. So what we want to do is make sure that everybody just agrees to keep those firearms locked up, and free gun locks are available everywhere, from the city of Santa Fe, from the state of New Mexico, from New Mexicans to prevent gun violence. I have a bunch at my house. You can call me up. I'll get one to you. It's very important to have a gun lock.
And on that note, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with Conversations Different.
My name is Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz, and I am the executive director with Solace Sexual Assault Services. Our mission is to prevent sexual violence and empower survivors of sexual violence through restoring dignity, strength, and resiliency. For almost 51 years, Solace has reduced the impact of sexual violence. We do it by focusing on human rights, social justice, hope, and dignity. We believe survivors are experts in their own experiences and acknowledge that empowering them is crucial to their healing. Our advocacy, forensic interviewing, and therapy services are centered to their needs. Our sexual violence prevention programs in schools and community is just as important. Please check our website at findsolace.org. And if in need, you can call our 24/7 hotline, which is 800-721-7273. Your support is crucial to the lives of survivors. Thank you. Gracias.
Welcome back to Conversations Different, where we're talking about gun violence and ways that we as individuals and as a society can reduce it. Going back to the last segment where we have the safe storage law, But it basically says if a kid takes your gun and then uses it, do we have a law or do we need a law that says if a thief takes your gun and then uses it to rob a bank and kill people, you, if you left it loose or something, what responsibility do I have as a homeowner and a gun owner to make sure that no one can get to my weapons?
Well, let's go back one step. Let's talk about store owners, firearm dealers. They need to have a really clear sense of what their obligation is to make sure that their firearms are not stolen. So we had a bill introduced that would put a, it was a very good law. It said, if you are a gun dealer, you have a responsibility to create policies to keep them safely locked, to train your employees, to just enact normal safety things that you would do at any store, any place of business. And if you don't follow your own policies and procedures, and something happens, you're going to be civilly liable. That bill was introduced, and I hope we get to see it next session because it was a really good law. Then comes the next step about a family negligently storing their firearms. It hasn't been tested yet what the relationship is between the child and the adult. If the kid is in your house, is a guest in your house, I think you have a duty of care. Just like you have a duty, you cannot let people walk out of your house drunk and drive out of your house. You can't let them walk out of your bar drunk and drive their car. It's the same concept.
Yeah. Yeah, I had read a story a few weeks ago about how people are carrying guns with them in their cars and they're getting stolen right and left. Whether because people are stealing the whole automobile and say, oh, look, there's a gun, an extra, or they're just breaking in and finding them. And people don't even do the basic of just having a little cable lock or a tiny gun safe, which are really affordable.
They don't even lock the car doors sometimes. They don't even lock the glove box. If you had, I always tell people, if you had $500 in cash, would you lock the glove box? Would you lock the door? Okay, this is way more important. You have to use simple common sense. And for people who say, well, what if an emergency comes up? Believe me, you can get that gun fast enough.
Yeah, especially if you had a safe where, you know, it opened with your fingerprints, because there's some really quick ways to get into it.
I can get into my bank account with just holding my phone up to my face. You can get into your gun lock just as easily.
Yeah, I always joke about the First Amendment is the right to assemble. And the Second Amendment, of course, is about firearms. And I don't think there's been a case that tested the idea that I don't want to assemble if everyone around me is armed. You know, even if it's legal, even if we have open carry and all of the things, or concealed carry, you know, which is a thing, you know, at what point do you not want to walk down the street because there's guys with long guns everywhere?
That's an important issue, especially coming up with this election, because we did pass a really important law saying you can't brandish your firearm at a polling place. It's really important for people to understand. It's not because we think you're going to shoot anyone. I mean, that's obviously a serious crime. We don't want to intimidate people when they're exercising such a fundamental right, the right to vote. They need to feel safe, and poll workers need to feel safe. If we don't have any safety in place for poll workers, we won't have any poll workers. So that's really critical.
Yeah, I was happy that passed. And I think actually that prosecutors don't use the brandish statute enough, because if you have a bunch of people sitting in testimony with their guns practically pointed at the people giving evidence, that isn't just a self-defense issue, that's brandishment.
I work at the legislature during the session. I do bill analysis. And there was a year where people were just walking around with guns all the time.
Yeah.
And it was really intimidating. So they passed an internal rule, no firearms at the roundhouse. Well, that should be at a lot of places.
Yeah.
We already have no firearms in liquor establishments, in schools, and certain public buildings. Let's make it realistic and say there's no reason to carry a firearm in a lot of public places, what we call like sensitive places.
And you know, that's actually something that has to be done at the state level, because I remember a few years ago in Santa Fe, there was a guy who liked to go armed to all the city council meetings. And he made people uncomfortable on purpose. This wasn't just like a benign, I carry a gun kind of thing. And the city could not do anything about it because of that amendment that says cities can't pass any laws regarding firearms. You can't even require like gun locks in Santa Fe if that's something the council wanted to do.
It's important that cities have their own regulations, but we really need a statewide regulation, and the city can't do it.
No.
Even if they had the authority, it wouldn't be meaningful. It really has to be a state statute.
I thought at that time that while this was happening, they should just go ahead and meet in schools, and that would solve it. I think sometimes you have to think around the problem and just say, you know what, we don't want to sit here while so-and-so has his weapon while we're discussing really sensitive issues, so we're just going to, you know, go here.
I'm going to see you at the Roundhouse. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think one of the things that drives me crazy about this whole issue of gun violence is that nobody wants gun violence, obviously. Yet, because it's so politicized and so partisan, you know, why can't we have Eddie Eagle classes in schools again so that kids understand more about gun safety? But if you did that, that people who hate guns would say, not in our schools. You know, why can't you safe storage your guns? And the, you know, the Second Amendment absolutes say, oh, no, you know, I can't get my gun to shoot the burglar who's not actually coming to my house anyway. So how do we get to a more rational place?
We can turn down the heat. It's possible to have really meaningful conversations. And I've thought about this a lot because I'm thinking, why do people feel they have to have guns? And people have genuine fear.
Yes.
And I want to respect that fear. I want to say, you have reasons that I might not understand, or they might not be in my experience.
Well, and they're also not rational when you compare them to the statistics of what happens right. If you have a gun in the home.
Fear is not rational.
No,
feels
it is not.
Fear is based on emotional response to something. And I want to respect people's need to feel safe. And so that goes for people who are gun owners and non-gun owners. What we need to do is really get a conversation going, because I really think we're mostly all on the same page.
Yeah. I'm not sure I think we are anymore, but I hope we can be again. I know that living in a neighborhood, which, you know, I always joke, I live in, you know, nice blue Santa Fe, and I have a couple of neighbors who are open carry guys, and they fly big, fat American flags, and a couple of them have long beards. And I think, are those trigger warnings? You know, and they're not. They're just people. And it's always interesting to see, how do you work past that? And how do you, let's say I'm going to buy a handgun because I'm unsafe coming to and from work. How many people then go to the shooting range? How many people learn how to use their weapon? How often do they shoot?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about that in the context of domestic violence, because we often hear, well, that those women need to have guns in their house to feel safe. Oh, my God, what crazy thinking is that? If you're in such a dangerous domestic violence situation, you need to get out of it. You don't need to have your own gun in the house. Because what's going to happen is you're going to shoot your child's father and you're going to end up in prison. And now you have a child with no parents at all.
Yeah.
That is not a solution. Anyone who thinks domestic violence victims are safer by having a gun has never been in a domestic violence situation. What they need is a safety plan that they've worked out with our great provider here in town, Esperanza Shelter, will help people work out that safety plan and keep them safe. Do not even think about arming a woman in that situation.
Unless there's someone who maybe is familiar with weapons and knows how to use them and can prove that it was self-defense at some point, you know.
Well, what normally happens with women is they don't shoot in the heat of the moment because there's a larger, more aggressive person
yeah.
that they're looking at. They wait until things are a little bit safer for them. And once that happens, once they're out of the absolute heat of the moment, that's first-degree murder. You know, he had it coming is not a defense.
No, and you don't get a pass for preventive murder, because probably by shooting, that person saved their life.
Yes.
But you don't, it doesn't count the same way. The other thing I think people underestimate is the fact that they would hesitate, and then that person attacking would take the gun away from them.
Absolutely. Not that Hollywood is the best presenter of reality, but we do see that all the time. Somebody pulls a gun and the other person disarms them, because one person is trained and one is not. One is big and one is small. One's terrified and one's aggressive. It's a lot of combinations that can go wrong there.
Yeah, that's why I don't personally, for me, believe in a gun for self-defense because I know I couldn't shoot. I'd get too scared or I'd shoot the wrong person because, you know, the dog comes in the middle of the night and I think, oh, it's a burglar. So I have like a bat. I think those are less deadly and more effective.
Yes, I have a cabin up in Chama and my neighbors all are armed. And many of them are very strong advocates for Second Amendment rights, but I have a baseball bat.
I like that. And I bet if there's an encounter, you're going to come out just fine.
I think so, too.
Thank you. On that note, we will be back next week with another Conversations Different.